Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by John Urson, managing partner of Schenck Price. John is a rather unique corporate attorney. He operates at the intersection of law, business, risk, and governance. He serves as a trusted counsel to family businesses, family offices, middle market companies, as well as banks, developers, and public entities. What makes John especially distinctive is that he brings both transactional depth and first chair litigation experience to the table, which gives him a rare real-world perspective on how deals succeed, how they fail, and where risk truly lives. John has supported multi-million dollar transactions, advised on complex succession and private equity deals, and guided family organizations through disputes that test leadership, ownership, and continuity. He is also a strong voice on the importance of planning early, especially in family and closely held businesses. Today, John's conversation is about business of family, the cost of waiting too long to plan, and what leaders often misunderstand about risk, succession, and control. John, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Well, I feel very welcome with that very kind introduction. That's very well put. I'm impressed.
So let's get into it. So you work with a wide range of family businesses and family offices. From your vantage point, what do most owners misunderstand about what good legal counsel should actually help them do?
So I think the first part of the answer is that I think that a lot of business owners look at their legal counsel as piecemeal. So that if they have a small real estate transaction, they'll use a real estate attorney. If they're getting a loan, they go find a banking attorney. They might have a separate, estate planning attorney. And when they're doing the piecemeal approach, they're losing out on having a real relationship, a much deeper relationship with someone who can serve as general counsel to them, that can become a value-added advisor. And that really comes from a longer relationship, handling all of the aspects of a business owner's life. You get to understand them. You get to understand them. You get to understand their family. Mm-hmm. Little things. Quick calls. Should I do this? I was thinking about this. An employee came to me and had this problem. How do I react? Sometimes it's the 3-minute phone call that saves that business owner a lot of money from making a mistake or going down the wrong road. And so I think my answer really is to, and this is going to be my answer to a lot of questions, I think, is to find that trusted advisor who has the right background for your business and develop a relationship. Mm. Rather than doing things piecemeal or transactional.
Makes a lot of sense. So given your background, you kind of have this rare blend of deep transactional work as well as first chair litigation experience. How does having seen deals unravel in court change the way you advise clients before they ever sign an agreement?
Yeah, so I think a lot of corporate counsel or business attorneys generally understand how a dispute or a conflict will eventually progress. But when you've been there and tried them and had trials to a judge or had jury trials, you see them differently. So if you take, to try and illustrate, if you have a real estate transaction that looks like it might be going bad, I start writing emails and start writing documents and notices, and I think every one of them is an exhibit in court one day, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. force the sale or for damages or something like that. And similarly, on a more general basis, if you think about juries, someone comes to us with an employee problem, a sexual harassment problem. Almost instantly, I'm trying to counter balance everything that we're doing and check everything we're doing against how that is going to look to a jury 9 months from now, a year and a half from now. You know, is a jury going to appreciate that we came immediately for the interview? Did we treat the employee who had the problem with respect and compassion and document it properly? You know, did we investigate deep enough the whole situation? And so, you know, it really does make you look at it through a different prism that I think really protects the business better.
Excellent, excellent. So, I'm always surprised, and certainly I've had many interviewed a number of people on this show. In some cases, the exit and succession plan was well entrenched, well in place, clearly articulated, understood by all. In some cases, it totally wasn't, you know. So, you've said before that, you know, planning is never a mistake. So, in your experience, why do so many, successful business owners doing great, have a great business, but they avoid that conversation of succession and exit planning? Why is that?
Why do people not buy life insurance? You know, because people don't like to think about it. The typical business owner, whether it's a first or second generation entrepreneur, they get very busy. They get very focused on the bottom line, and planning for an exit or planning for succession 5, 10, or 20 years later, it doesn't add to the bottom line, right? So they put it off, right? And equally, sometimes it's cost avoidance. So sometimes people think, okay, if I go and sit and talk to the lawyer and we start to develop a plan, a buy sell agreement, a trust, whatever it's going to be, that's going to cost me money. Sometimes, you know, it can be a material amount of money. And so they put it off. And I think that's where having the relationship with your group of advisors who can essentially, nudge you once in a while and say, hey, remember we said we were going to talk about that succession plan and getting your two kids involved? When are we going to have that conversation? Okay, after the new year. Okay, no problem. I'll call you in January, right? So it's helpful to have the person who understands how important the issue is be involved and then, you know, be able to help you with the follow-up.
So,
Just as if you talk to the life insurance salesman and they send you an email 3 times a week, right?
yeah, I mean, certainly, I've seen this situation, and maybe you have too, and can kind of weigh in or give some guidance where you have a next generation that's kind of sitting in line. There is no formalized succession plan, and that person's getting a little nervous because
Sure.
nothing's been put down on paper. So, were you to guide or advise that next generation? Sometimes they don't even know how to have the conversation, you know, like where to begin. So,
Right.
you know, if I were a second gen and I had a father or daughter still kind of maybe entrenched in the CEO role, and I knew that, you know, we were coming up on time for them to step down, how would you guide me in that conversation? How might I broach that subject if it's never been formally articulated?
Well, I think it's important to triangulate it because maybe the child in the business has a good enough relationship to sit down and they just need to be guided as to an outline of the subjects to be discussed. Sometimes that's the case. But sometimes it's triangulating, figuring out who is closest to the founder, the owner, an accountant, a business friend, the attorney who could say, I was talking to Jim or Sandy, and they're concerned about what's going to happen 5 years from now. Have you sat and talked with them about it? Sometimes it's preparing the second generation for the conversation by giving them an outline of what to discuss, and sometimes it's triangulating through the network of business advisors to bring up the subject.
Excellent. Yeah. And I know in my case it was the managing partner of our accounting firm who ultimately helped us come to terms with the final buy sell, which I was doing some house cleaning and I found an old piece of notebook paper with my signature and my father's signature and a dollar amount.
Yeah,
It's
and
kind of funny,
in
but that was it.
different segments of life, it may be a different person who could have that conversation.
Yeah, good point. So, when a family business does approach you with some issue, what are the warning signs that they maybe waited too long to address whatever issue was on the table, whether it be issues of ownership, governance, or maybe even transition?
So I think there's probably many warning signs, but the two that come to mind quickest are that it is starting to affect the business. So, someone who had a founder, an entrepreneur who had a ton of energy at 55, 58, is now 67 and starting to slow down, and it's impacting the business. The business is slowing down, it's not keeping up with technology, it's not as profitable, and then that impacts the succession or exit plan, and sometimes dramatically. The second thing that is a real warning sign is whether it's a succession plan to a family member or a succession plan to a key employee, you can, as your earlier question suggested, you could start to lose one of those people because they stayed in the business, they stayed active, they see themselves in the chain of succession taking over the business. But now the founder is 67, 70, 72, and they show no signs and there's no communication of leaving. You stand a real chance of losing one of those key people, family member or key employee, and that can really damage a succession plan, dramatically.
I mean, I know of a past guest where thankfully the next generation was entrenched in the business. However, the father passed suddenly, unexpectedly, and there, I don't think there wasn't some scrambling going on because a lot of institutional knowledge passed with him, and thankfully they were well enough entrenched to be able to pick up the ball. But it was not an easy transition by any means, and a lot of times I think we think as the CEO we're invincible and we're going to live forever and nothing's ever going to happen. And unfortunately, sometimes that's just not the case. And we have to be ready and we have to have the right mechanisms in place to for the continuity of prosperity and the continuity of the business, which
Of
is ultimately
course.
what we all want,
Yes.
When it comes to planning, I think sometimes maybe owners think that planning too early maybe restricts them in some way or reduces their flexibility. But from a legal and business perspective, why would you say the opposite is actually true? That planning.
So I make a little bit of a distinction to make your point. I think that seriously, you could never plan too early. I mean, from the time you form the business, to the time it begins to have success, to the time it's accelerating, the planning should be part of that whole life cycle. What sometimes the primary member of the business doesn't think about is planning and implementation are two different things. So you should have the plan, you should refine the plan, the plan should change with your business, you should be thinking about it as your key employees advance or your children get older and you want them to be part of the business. But you can pull the trigger as to when it's implemented. You can pull the trigger as to when you inform everybody in the company, start to sign documents, put things in place. So planning and implementation are two different things. And I think you can never plan too early, and I think you have to implement strategically.
So across your career, you've advised both small, closely held family business structures as well as in a multi-entity family business structures. So talk for a moment about how does the complexity of the family dynamic amplify, say, the legal risk if anything is left, say, informally handshake or undocumented?
It's sort of the nature of what can go wrong without planning, right? But so in order to get the planning, there needs to be a certain amount of analysis and communication. So especially in a family situation, the example you gave before about having the managing partner of the accounting firm know you well enough to so that you could have the conversation with them. When a business operates and something happens to the founder, whether it's health, death, disability, whatever it is, and that person suddenly goes away, the unanswered questions regarding people's roles, the key employees, the strategic decisions, they're all going to be, potential subjects for conflict. Whereas, the amount of planning can change, but if there's a key group of advisors, they'll know the players involved. They'll know, what the conversations have been about which child should have this role and which child should have that role, and about strategic decisions. And the planning process really focuses on that communication and answering those questions so that you don't end up with numerous points of conflict when someone is no longer in a position to run the company.
And as an outside advisor, you stand to be in a very advantageous vantage point, because certainly, as you've seen firsthand, in a family business, there's the dynamics of the business and there's the dynamics of the family, you know, and sometimes they can get a little bit, I'll just say, muddy, right? But have you ever had a scenario where you've seen something of a disconnect, where there was a seeming succession in play, where there was maybe a first gen and there was a second gen that was kind of in line to succeed, but there might have been a disconnect, such as what the founder wanted, which is, I'm going to pass this business on to my son or my daughter, and a question of readiness for that next generation to take the baton and function as the next generation CEO. So when you see those situations, like, how do you have those, call them the hard conversations, the heart to hearts?
Well, and it's hard conversations on both sides, right? Because it's pretty fundamental that, usually the founder, the entrepreneur who developed the business, usually has a very long view and is usually very patient and has learned a lot by experience, right? And so often, they will place a child in a sales role, right? And then think that they can just pull a lever and that person's going to step into, a C-suite position, but they haven't watched firsthand how to be patient, how to look long-term strategy, what good financing looks like, what a good and bad deal looks like, how to be patient and say no to a deal and wait for the deal to come back around to you. So the founder has to take the time to both communicate, but then let the up and coming key employee or family member have the experience to learn directly from the founder. That's the only way you're going to have a true continuum of the philosophy of the business. Otherwise, very often, I'm sure you see it. The founder has the long-term analysis and patience. And the next generation comes in and thinks it knows more than it knows, and wants to do things on a very short-term basis, quick decisions, and sometimes that does not work.
I mean, there's truly a, you know, when you're a next generation business, there's always a balancing act. You obviously want to honor the business and the legacy, yet you also recognize, by virtue of being there, times have changed, generations have changed. Not only the generational shift within the business, but certainly clientele, market conditions, wants and needs, and supply and demand have all shifted as well. So there's that balance to certainly carry forward the legacy, but also recognize that one also has to be something of a change agent in the organization too.
I think it's almost across all business types. Certainly technology is moving faster and evolving faster, right? But that doesn't mean that some of the lessons learned of the founder building the business couldn't also be applied to, the world that we live in now.
100%. When after my father exited and the buyout was complete, I would still turn to him for advice, and he'd often say, "Well, I don't understand the technology of your business anymore. It's beyond me." And interesting, John, I was turning to him for people advice, Well, tell me how to handle this person. I've got this problem. He's like, oh, I know how to do that. And he did, because he was a tremendous person ambassador. He was great with people, so he always knew what to do.
The pace may change, but a lot of the fundamental issues that business owners deal with don't change.
Very true, very true. So, for many family businesses, after a time, and they've been very successful and for a long time, sometimes private equity comes knocking, or acquisitions come knocking, because they recognize all of the inherent values of the family business, that continuity of prosperity, sometimes across generations, continuity of clientele or workforce, or the stability that a family business often brings when it comes to prosperity. So, how to what extent should family businesses, and they have mixed feelings about private equity, certainly from those that I've interviewed, but how should they be thinking differently about outside capital compared to maybe a non-family business enterprise?
So I think that it's very important that the family business becomes very well educated with respect to the pros and cons of private equity. And like many of the answers that I've given to other questions, it really does take a team approach because I've had many family businesses call me and say, "Great day, private equity fund just offered us 25 million." And I say, "Great." And then we sit down with the accountant and the financial advisor and we say, "Guys, that's 5 million each and you're 48. And 40% of that is going to go away with taxes. And let's look at your lifestyle. Are you going to live from now going forward on $3 million?" But sometimes they do. Sometimes they have another job lined up and they're gonna put that money in the bank. And then there's mixed transactions where they get taken over by private equity and then they're gonna be part of private equity and work there for X amount of time. And we just make sure that they're really well educated to understand the control issues. I frequently say with private equity, the people who are selling you the deal are not gonna be your managers 6 months from now. The people who sell the deal are very good at selling the deal. These are very, very sophisticated people, but it's a different group of people that you're now going to be reporting your financials to, and they're going to be making decisions about your business that you've typically made within the family.
That is a huge point, and I'm so glad you raised it, because a lot of times I think it's easy to get enamored, when you're being courted, and I've
Yes.
seen that a lot. It feels good. Somebody sees value in your enterprise, and is willing to pay for it. But there's a lot more to it than that, as you've rightly pointed out. And most certainly, I think that's really where outside guidance shines. Because you can think objectively, you're not part of the family. So,
Yes, that's right.
when it comes to putting a deal together, a family business says, okay, there isn't that next generation to succeed. It's time. We're going to exit. What are some of the issues that in the deal that you see the leadership kind of maybe they're glossing over or missing, that they might come to regret later? What are some things that they should be really on the lookout for when it comes to?
In an exit situation? Yeah. So I think the two primary things, one is one's business, one's lifestyle. But the primary thing is very often the money that's quoted is not all upfront and the money is over time. And you have to really analyze those financial terms to see if they really are market, to see if they're beneficial, and to see if they properly reflect the risk. I just last week I had a business come to me and somebody wants to take it over and they want to pay about 30% down and they want to spend the rest over 10 years. And the broker who was involved was selling them on the amount they were going to get, which included all the interest, right? And that's great if you get it all. If you don't get it all, great, you're going to get back what's left of your business, but 7 years from now, do you really want to re-enter that business with a broken company and you didn't get that money? So I think you gloss over the terms again. They fall in love with the big number, with the headline number, right? And then the second thing is the lifestyle. I've had people exit under those circumstances, and they knew exactly the lifestyle they were going to live, and they're very conservative, and they have their money saved, and they're very happy. And I've had other people who did not understand the finances of it, and bought this and bought that and bought that, and then realized, 3 years from now they were really out of money or behind the eight ball, and regretted not having the income stream from the business again. So I think it's really analyzing the deal terms and making sure you understand what your lifestyle looks like economically after the deal.
Yeah. And having the either it is a, whether it be one's 2.0 or having an identity that stands beyond the business, because I've certainly seen this, and you may have as well, John, is that a business owner or a family business, they exit a business, they exit for a large sum of money, and one would think there should be some degree of elation and happiness. And oftentimes, what I've seen is sometimes depression sets in, because that was their identity. That was who they were for a really long time. And now, based on the rules of the deal, they can't be that anymore.
It's what they talked about at dinner, and now they're bored.
So, in your role with a lot of the companies you serve as, again, that trusted advisor, the general counsel, not just a counsel when it comes to deal making. But talk a little bit about how having that long-term advisory role changes the nature and tempo and tenor of conversations you can have with your owner clients about risk, about decision making, about whatever might be on their mind relative to the organization.
Sure. I think that having represented a business over a longer amount of time, and certainly most often in the arc of its growth, you know so much about the business. I get to know something about this particular manufacturing business. I've seen so many contracts. I know what the pitfalls are. I know if they have too much concentration in one particular customer. But more importantly, it's the human factor. I get to know them. I get to know the way they think. I get to know how they interrelate with their children. I get to know the children because the children work in the business. But spending habits and risk tolerance, those things are all very important, because when something goes wrong, and I just had this recently, we had a very large financial problem at a family business, and there was a big threat. And knowing them very well, we were able to have very quick, very detailed, very risk calculating conversations, because I had known their whole world for that amount of time. And unfortunately, you can't sit down in a consultation with a new professional and convey that in 1 hour, right? I could have never advised them, and we got a very good result in this particular case where we had a threat of litigation. We got a very good result, but I never would have been able to advise them over a 10-day period based upon a 1 hour consultation. I simply wouldn't, would not have been able to understand their risk tolerance and the way they looked at things. So it makes a big difference. And the other thing that I'll say very quickly is what I said to you before is sometimes you talk about the big things, but sometimes it's the little things. A quick call, a 5-minute call at the end of the day, we have this complaint from this employee, should I deal with this? How should I meet with them? Is it a disability problem? Is it a wage problem? Is it a sex harassment issue? And 3 minutes of advice allows them to process it properly and avoid a larger problem. That happens quite a bit.
Excellent. So we touched on this as before as well, this idea that in a family enterprise, there's what is right and what feels right. Emotion and maybe economics often get intertwined and often get mixed up, if you will. So when a client of yours is faced with a situation, how do you help them kind of separate what they're feeling and the emotional kind of magnitude of the issue to what is the legitimate, either legal or responsible or reasonable approach to that initiative? How do you help them get that emotional separation from and perspective.
Yeah, well, so I think that's it's sort of a key role because although I know my clients and care about them and like them, I'm not emotional about their problems. The problems are not going to affect me directly, therefore I can be very objective. And so I frequently say to my clients that, we just have to always make sure we're playing chess, not checkers, right? So a lot of times they'll have an issue with a key employee, a family member, and they have an emotional reaction that they want to do something positive or negative for that person. And you talk them through that there's consequences to this, and what they want to accomplish in 1 month that may not be very good for 6 months or a year or the 5-year plan, right? And then the other thing is, as I said multiple times today, you triangulate these things because sometimes it'll impact an accounting issue. Sometimes the financial advisor will be involved. Sometimes it becomes a risk issue with the insurance advisor. So I think the making them think about the consequences over a longer time horizon to try and get the emotion out of it and keeping the team approach really works.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, in your practice, you also advise, outside of family governed businesses, municipalities, school boards, and some public entities. What, if any, lessons from these types of organizations have you picked up on that that the family business enterprise could take a lesson from or borrow from?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny question because my quick answer is none. I'm still yet to find the government entity that functions as efficiently and productively as private companies, particularly small and mid-sized businesses. But if I was searching for an answer, I think what government entities are good at is there's a lot of structure and a lot of procedure. And that does lead to the sustainability of the institution. You could kind of quickly comment that maybe sometimes there's too much regulation and so forth, but thinking about the structure and the procedure is key. I mean, how many businesses do we have in their midlife cycle who still don't have an employment manual, right? Or disaster planning protocols, or IT protocols, that kind of stuff, right? The flip side to the question is, I'd love to teach a course for governments on the great things that private enterprise does that they could learn from. So there could be a little bit both ways, but I think the structure and the procedure is probably worth looking at.
Excellent point. So, no business leader wants to find themselves faced with litigation on either end, right? Because we all know litigation is costly, both not just in terms of money, but also in terms of probably what we prize sometimes more than money, which is time, right? So, and certainly sometimes litigation is necessary, as I'm sure you found that there's no other way, but if you think back on some of the cases that have gone to litigation, would you ever in the look back say, gosh, that totally could have been avoided if we documented better, if we addressed things earlier, if we put things down in writing? Have you ever kind of done a look back and said, boy, that this is a big one, and this really could have been avoided if there was the proper, governance or rules or guidance or procedures or documentation in place to have headed this off at the pass?
Sure. Frequently. We in anything you read, you're going to read a lot about the 5 Ds of succession planning, right? Death, disability, divorce, disagreement, distress, and I always add disqualification as the sixth because that comes up. And my quick story to you is on disqualification. So, family businesses frequently want to add people to the equity structure too quickly and without really thinking it through with respect to the 5 Ds or the one I just added. So we had one not long ago where they added them, and they, of course, in the beginning thought everything was going to go fine, and it turns out it didn't, and it turns out the person was not a good fit for the business and had a substance abuse problem. And so very quickly, instead of it becoming a disqualifying issue under the operating agreement, where the person would simply be removed from the business and have to go find employment somewhere else, the operating agreement, which I did not do, was not as clear. And the person said, fine, I'm fired, but I still own 25% of the business. And so then you have to go through, are you going to dilute them through capital calls? Are you going to file suit to eject them from the business? Are you going to partition it? Are you going to start over, et cetera? And that was a pretty simple example of not thinking through the basic things that could go wrong when you add somebody to a business and not building in the lever to pull if somebody, becomes long-term disabled or becomes disqualified because of a substance abuse problem or a criminal conviction or something that prevents them from functioning properly in the business. So, and that case did go to court, and eventually it was decided in the business owner's favor because, typically the person who's being ejected from the business then says, well, the business is worth $25 million, and the founder says, hey, we're still developing. We barely have sales yet. We're worth 2 million, right? And that's the fight. And then you're spending money on appraisers, all because you didn't have a simple lever in the business to disconnect somebody who wasn't performing.
And I can certainly attest that I've seen that so many times where especially in that startup mode, those that are entrepreneurial, they want to bring people along, bring them on, giving them equity, not really thinking about that is a that is a big commitment.
Yes.
That's bigger than maybe they bargained for. So that's huge advice. When it comes to next generation transition, whether it be to a family member or sometimes we've also seen businesses where that successor is a non-family member, where they're bringing somebody from the outside to govern. How do you help some of your close clients who might be going through that or contemplating that find that balance between that control and trust? You've got to relinquish control, you've got to have the trust in that individual, and sometimes that's hard even when it's a family member, to relinquish control and trust, especially if it's the founder, who's
Yes.
relinquishing the reins. So how do you help them navigate that?
Well, I think it touches on some of the things we've talked about today. You have to do some planning. You have to decide when to implement it, but then you have to have patience because the control versus trust, the founder is not going to want to pull a lever and turn it over tomorrow. And the key employee or the family member who's ascending, they're not ready. So you have to give them that time to shadow you, to watch the decision making, to be in meetings, to understand your supply chain, your finances, your employees, whatever it is. And so at the stage where you've implemented the plan, we just preach a good runway and plenty of patience.
And it's a great point, and not surprising as I think back on past guests, those that have successfully navigated to the next generation, there's a seemingly simple but important commonality, and it was in my case too, is that we had exposure to the business at very, very young ages.
Yes.
5 years old, 7 years old, coming into the office with mom or dad, seeing how the operation worked, and sometimes just kind of through osmosis or subconsciously, little bits and pieces started to fall into place.
Yeah.
And for a lot of us that were really young, it just seemed like a game. We were kids,
Yeah.
but it all kind of stacked up. And then over time, it's like there was a I think a faster readiness for that early exposure. So for anyone listening, if you got a little one, bring them to work. Show them what you do.
Great, great plan.
So if you could sit down with to every business owner listening right now to our show, and for one mandatory conversation early in their journey, and whether that journey involved an exit, a succession, or a raising of capital, what would you say? Hey, this is, if nothing else, here's something we've really got to talk about first.
Team of advisors.
Team of advisors.
Build it, cultivate it, make it long term, Make sure that at each stage of the business, each of the advisors that you have are appropriate for your level of size and sophistication, and then get the benefit of having that team. But thinking about that as a team approach, from a very early stage and building that team, you're not going to magically have that team all at once, but as the business develops, cultivating that team of advisors, I think, is the most important thing.
Awesome. John, you've been a wealth of information today. I feel like we could talk to you all day. So last question I ask you, if somebody's listening and they want to connect with you or learn more about you or learn more about the firm, what's the best way for them to do that?
I think the easiest way is just to go right to our website, spsk.com. And you'll certainly find me and find our other lawyers, and we'd certainly be happy to talk with your guests and help them.
Awesome. Well, John, this conversation certainly reinforces a hard truth that many business owners unfortunately learn too late, that success does not eliminate risk and growth does not replace the need for planning. What stands out is your ability to, dive deep, see around the corners, and really speak not just legally, but operationally, as well as having a clear understanding of the emotional dynamics at play in the family governed entity. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective and for challenging those listeners out there to plan earlier, to think deeper, and ultimately lead with better clarity as a result. Again, we've been speaking with John Urson of Schenck Price, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.delianet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeliaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.